The 2019-2020 Capital Investments Committee meeting will come to order. It is exciting for me to be here today with you all who picked to be on this committee and I presume you're going on my journey with me into the future. But to start out with, I think we have to kind of think about what's happened in the immediate past and then a little bit further into the 1900s and what helped us get here today. And so we can see the motivation of the investments that states have made, the state has made in communities and regions across the state. We have wonderful things in your packet, that maps and roll calls, the names of the committee on a graphic thing. It's like never before has happened. And so we're going forth with all the bells and whistles we can dream of. But I hope that we won't dream too much. I expect that I've had more requests for meetings with people from the outside, the public, for important meetings that we have to have right away because I don't know why because. And so be patient with me if you don't get a call back real soon. Till I test the waters and get my feet wet. I'm not a swimmer, and so I don't go above the ankles. But I do walk every morning at, this morning I left my floor at 20 to 7. And so if you care to partake in a morning walk, you could be here doing 20 to 7 and 7, because that's when I'll be starting on the mornings that we don't have 8 o'clock committee meetings. A little bit later, more toward 10 to 7. Yesterday was 10 to 7. So we're going to work those, we're going to work your appointments in, but they're not going to be real prompt. Not this week and not next week, probably. But then we'll fit them in. But and also, yesterday, a question came to my attention. Ms. Murphy, are you going to sign on to our bills or not? What's your policy? Oh, my gosh, I never even thought of a policy. What was your policy, Chair?
Thank you, Chair Murphy.
Good what morning. Was your policy?
My policy was I only signed on to bills that directly affected my district.
Okay.
I was pretty judicious about not signing on to a lot of other bills because it put me in sometimes an uncomfortable position, yeah. Madam Chair.
Let me thank you for sharing that with me. Chair Erdahl, what was your policy when you were chair?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Bills that affected my district? Bills that were my bills, and if I felt like it. I mean, okay. Sometimes an issue that is close to me for whatever other reason, and somebody might have a bill that I really think was good that I wanted to see, and I would sign on. But that really was at a minimum. I mean, as a general policy, it's wise not to sign on to a lot of these bills because everyone wants the chair of the committee to be on their bill.
Yeah, that's what I came to realization yesterday.
I do have a bill I'd like you to sign on to, though.
I'm going to consider the advice that I've just received. And I've been on bonding before, not immediately before, but for 14 years I've been on the bonding committee with 10 chairs. So here we go again, a new opportunity with new people. And so I will let you know, as you come to me, whose policy advice I'm going to take. But I might be wishy-washy. We'll see. Anyway, Andrew Lee is a nonpartisan staff member, our fiscal analyst that has been assigned to us from the Fiscal Analyst Department. And he has created a wonderful, informative worksheet, spreadsheet. Mr. Lee, will you tell us a little bit about yourself and how long you've been around here and where you were trained and whatever else you want to share with us before you start, and then take us through the worksheet, will you, which is a summary of the capital investment work that has been done since 2000 up through 2018. Mr. Lee.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Andrew Lee from House Fiscal Staff. I've been on the Capital Investment Committee and also the Transportation Committee for, this will be my seventh session now. Before that, I went to the University of Minnesota for urban and regional planning, and happy to be here. So the spreadsheet that we'll be looking at today looks like this. It should be in your packet. This is a project that I worked on over the interim this last year, trying to look back at all of the past capital investment bill appropriations going back to 2000. And the reason I chose 2000 was because I had wanted to go back 20 years because GO bonds typically have a life of 20 years. However, in the 1998 bill, there were a number of general fund appropriations that then were, during a deficit, converted to GO bonds, and then some of them were canceled, some of them were reauthorized, and some of them were changed. So I thought that 2000 would be probably the cleanest comparison to look back. So what you have is all of, in every bonding bill, all of the GO authorizations, so that's state bonds, and then a few different other bonding mechanisms. What isn't included in here are any trunk highway bonds or trunk highway spending. So this is just looking at the general fund side of the ledger in terms of capital appropriations. It also doesn't include capital projects that were in other bills, like the legacy bill or HHS or education. This is just looking at bonding. So I'll just very briefly go through, I won't go through every single item, but just make a few notes. On the second and third pages, you'll see the University of Minnesota, and then on the third page, you'll start to see Minnesota State. So the University of Minnesota, the top line, line one, shows the higher education asset preservation appropriations. And then for Minnesota State, line 60 shows the asset preservation appropriations for Minnesota State. One kind of complexity when you're looking at the higher ed appropriations between the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State is that for projects that aren't asset preservation, the two university systems finance a third of the cost. So when the system is building a new building, typically the University of Minnesota would get two-thirds of the cost from the state and then finance a third of it itself. And you'll see in a few places the University of Minnesota and the MinSCU appropriations are divided by campus, that MinSCU has a lot more user financing. And that's because the state issues the debt for the MinSCU share of the cost, but then the system from its own sources like tuition or private fundraising pays the state for the debt service. That used to be the case for the University of Minnesota as well, but in the, I believe in 2002 and going for, and past that, the university has financed its one-third share itself, and the state just pays for the GO cost and doesn't finance the user financing part. So the next few pages online, or on page four, you can see the Department of Education, the Minnesota State Academies, and then starting on page five is the DNR. And you can see on line 122 through 136 are all the flood hazard mitigation appropriations. Sometimes the appropriations have been just to the general program, and sometimes they're for specific communities. And then moving on to page six, you can see the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And on page seven, the Board of Soil and Water Resources. And then agriculture, the zoo, and amateur sports commission on page seven. Page eight has the Department of Administration. A big item that you can see here is on line 230 and 231. That's the state capital restoration, which the total is about $322 million over the course of a number of years. So going back to 2000, but the most recent appropriations for that were in 2015. Then you can also see Minute Military Affairs in the Department of Public Safety. On page nine is the Department of Transportation. I'm going to pause here for just a second because, as I noted before, this doesn't include any of the trunk highway spending. So none of the constitutionally dedicated funding streams for state highways or local highways are included in this. This is just looking at the general fund or GO-backed portion of funding for the Department of Transportation. And a few of the bigger items at the top, lines 254, 255, 256, and 257 are the local road and bridge grant programs that go out to local units of government.
And just very briefly, tell us why they don't include the trunk highway investments.
Madam Chair and members, there could definitely be an argument that that would be included in capital investment, and oftentimes the capital investment bill has included trunk highway appropriations. I thought for this analysis, I wanted just to focus on the general fund-backed sources, not the constitutionally dedicated sources of transportation. As I think many committee members know, or you'll certainly learn in the future, transportation is sort of unique in that the vast majority of the revenues for transportation are constitutionally dedicated only for roads specifically. And then most of the spending allocation is also constitutionally dedicated or statutorily allocated in a pretty strict way. So it's a bit of a different beast than the rest of capital finance in general in the state.
Keep it simple, right?
And then, Madam Chair, the bottom of page nine, you can see the Metropolitan Council. One thing that I'll note with this is on line 272 and 273, this is grant programs for the Metro Regional Parks. I'll also pause here to make a note. You see on 273, this is the first of a few places that you can see under the fund ERAP. This is the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund Appropriations Bonds authorized in last year's bonding bill. So just as a note, when you're reading this page, you can see the fund type GO is General Obligation Bonds, GF is General Fund, and then there's a few other funds, but there's a key in the front page. So moving on to page 10, you can see the Department of Human Services with a few larger items line 291, the St. Peter State Security Hospital. You can see that has cost about $124 million in capital outlay over the last 18 years. And then another relatively large item on line 295, the Moose Lake sex offender facility. And you can see the Department of Veterans Affairs, Department of Corrections. And then moving on to page 11 is the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Now, if members have been on the Capital Investment Committee before, we'll probably notice that usually in this area is where a lot of grants to local units of government are. For the purposes of this spreadsheet, I tried to separate out all the grants to political subdivisions that were named in a capital investment bill and show them later in the spreadsheet. So we'll get to those in a little bit. Then you can see the Public Facilities Authority. This is grants for wastewater and drinking water infrastructure. And then the Housing Finance Agency, and this is only part of the appropriations for the Housing Finance Agency. This is the GO and General Fund portion, and a little bit later in the spreadsheet, you'll see the appropriation bonds. Then on page 12 is the Historical Society, and as a little side note, below the Historical Society, you can see on line 364 the bond sale expenses. This is the cost of issuing debt for every bonding bill. And then on page 12 starts a series of sections on the grants to the political subdivisions. So you can see starting in the Northwest, and I've divided this by the six planning regions that DEED has in kind of thinking about the different regions of the state. And there's a lot of different ways you could draw lines or think about different regions of the state, but that's the DEED one is what I'm using. And you should also have in your packet a map showing the division by counties of the regions. So I'll just briefly skip on through to the last page. And note kind of two other areas. So on the bottom of page 21 is disaster appropriations. So you can see that in 2007, 2009, and 2015, there are a few larger disaster appropriations. Oftentimes, disaster appropriations haven't been covered in bonding bills, but sometimes they are. Sometimes they're GO and a mix of GO and general fund. And then below that are the appropriation bonds. And appropriation bonds are slightly different from GO bonds, and we'll get into this in the presentation on Thursday. But they can have a different structure in terms of how long the bonds last and what kind of a guarantee they are to bond buyers. So GO bonds have the full faith and credit of the state, whereas appropriation bonds just have a statutory promise of payment. So you can see on line 783 and 784 and 785 the other MHFA appropriation bonds. And then I'll just note a few of the larger items on lines 787 and 788 are the University of Minnesota bonds for the stadium and biosciences facilities. And then on line, one of the largest appropriation bond to date was in 2011 on line 789, the state appropriation refunding bonds. This was in 2011 when the state had a deficit. Part of the stream of revenue that the state was receiving from the tobacco settlement in the late 90s was securitized to cover that one-time deficit, so to cover about $650 million in the state's deficit. And so then we have to pay that back over the course of 30 years. So that is that appropriation there. And in the next presentation, we'll be getting into the into what that debt service payment looks like. With that, I think I'll close, and if there's any questions.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Lee, for your presentation. I've worked with Mr. Lee a lot over the last 4 years between capital investment and transportation, and he is amazing when it comes to spreadsheets and numbers and getting his work done well and on time. However, I have to note that Mr. Lee's is not famous for his spelling. And if you would all turn to line 558, This is the Lake Redwood project. It is not a de-rigging project. It's a dredging project. I apologize, Mr. Lee, but I couldn't help myself.
It was your big chance. So we have to change. De-rigging to what?
Dredging.
Dredging.
It's a new term of art. I'm not familiar with it.
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, no, I appreciate the correction. It isn't the first time I've misspelled things on a spreadsheet. So.
And that's all right, as long as it doesn't happen again. Now, any other questions or statements to make about quality of the information that we've been given and the hugeness of it? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Lee, as I look at the very, very end of this, I'm looking at the totals for each of the years, and you don't seem to have given us that in a capsule. That might be nice to see so we can see what we've been doing every year back to 2000 and those years when we didn't bond and those series of years of 3 or 4 years where we bonded every year.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Dean, you're absolutely right. I didn't include the totals. This is sort of a work in progress. Part of the reason I didn't include the totals is because every year there are cancellations, so I wanted to get at what the net number was. So right now you're looking at everything that has been authorized, but subsequent to this authorization, there's also cancellations. I have a rough figure, which is about, going back to 2000, it's about $12.5 billion in GO, general fund, and other authorizations, but I wanted to get that number as precise as I could, and it's not quite done yet. But in the future, you'll have it.
Representative. Thank you.
I noticed a couple of places. Sorry. I noticed a couple of places where the number just ended and we quit using that type of funding and that kind of occurrence over a long period of time after that. And then also to the last thing that you were saying, is there available kind of instruction or learning to know that certain types of things have a high propensity to cancellation, or certain types of decision-making leads to higher percentages of cancellation? I'm going to the point is that better decision-making is oftentimes can be measured by decisions that actually live. They stay there for a while. And I don't know if there's a way for that to be preened out of this kind of financial analysis.
Madam Chair and Representative Stauch, yes. So every project will have at its end date a certain amount canceled because usually they don't spend every penny. It's a little hard to track down exactly how much of every project did cancel, and some projects that never actually get started get canceled in their entirety because the local match was never made or something like that. But, I think one of the things that you'll notice in here in terms of seeing how certain things only get, you only see the project type once and then it never happens again, as sort of the one-off nature of capital investment bills. Usually, you only need to build a building once, and then it doesn't, and then like that cost isn't recurring again. Whereas you can see a lot of the recurring costs are when there's programmatic decisions where money is appropriated, say, for asset preservation. And another note on cancellations, a lot of the state agencies have, the University of Minnesota, MinSCU, and the DNR allow capital projects that have money left over, rather than being canceled, can be converted to asset preservation, because even those relatively small dollar amounts can be spent in asset preservation.
Thank you.
Any other questions at this time? Well, if you think of some, we can answer them on Thursday. because we're not going to drop this idea. The second item, thank you, Mr. Lee. The second item on our agenda today is to have reports from members about capital investments that were made in their district or their cities or their regions. Like Mr. Lee was talking about the initiative districts that DEED runs and that sometimes comes forth with brilliant ideas and investment opportunities. And I don't want to put anyone on the spot so much, but I would like to talk about the time period before 2000. And so in a couple cases, you were little kids. But not so much for some of us. In my district, this past year, this past summer, we celebrated two huge state initiatives that came about from representatives. And the probably the one that's had the most impact on the most people at this time, although the other one is just coming right up there. The second one is the Natural Resources Research Institute, and we'll be hearing more about that later in the session because there may be more discussions about them. But we're also going to hear about the second initiative of Willard Munger. Willard Munger was a representative, the longest-serving representative for many, many years until Lyndon Carlson and Phyllis Kahn passed him up. And so Lyndon Carlson is the longest-serving representative ever in the House of Representatives. And Willard Munger is second. But in July, maybe 15th or 17th, I'm not sure, Mary Murphy is going to pass him. If she is so lucky to live. But you know what? Willard Munger was my representative for a good share of my growing up years and my school years. And then he lost my area, and my first term in office, I had most of what had one time been Willard Munger's district in rural Duluth. But Willard Munger was an environmentalist, and he was a man of vision that I've never seen anyone equal. And he created, with Jim Oberstar, our congressman at the time, and because of the passage of the Clean Water Act, Federal Clean Water Act, the idea that Lake Superior should get cleaned up. Western Duluth had a steel plant. The areas along the river, St. Louis River, that goes way up into Rob Eklund's district and Representative Lissigard's district, the headwaters. And St. Louis River is a working river for all of its life, and it came down and into through the Cloquet paper companies and then down into the steel plant area and then along the bayfront of Duluth. And at one time, you know, all rivers were pure and clean and the clean water was there. But by the 1960s, that water was so polluted, people were not going fishing at all on the bay. And in St. Louis River, for a good part of the St. Louis River, the lower St. Louis River, a good part of it wasn't. So by legislative initiative, the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District was created. And that was a combination, a partnership of two counties, Carlton County, St. Louis County, Southern St. Louis County, many cities, and over 20 townships. And it became a freestanding entity, the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District. And we celebrated its 40th year this year. And you know what? People are fishing. People are eating the fish. The water, people are kayaking. People are canoeing. Minnesota Power is still using St. Louis River for generating power and energy. The plants are still alive, not all of them, but the survivors, the lumberjacks, are still lumbering. And Babe and Blue Ox over in Bemidji are just a little bit jealous of all the changes that have taken place. But there's hope for the future. The steel plant site is almost pure, cleaned up. It'll never be absolutely what it was before they built Morgan Park and those other company towns in that area. But there is a future for Lake Superior. And do you know how many breweries? I don't even know how many tap rooms have opened up because of the clean water from Lake Superior. It's such a success. And I just think it's such a success in government working together, in people demanding change, and in environmental groups working together, the Save St. Louis River groups were still working to just make everything better. And Lake Superior is pretty close to meeting the standards that's supposed to have. And so we're going forth with that. But that is the one that I think has had the most impact on the most people of northeastern Minnesota. And all the states joining the Great Lakes down the way, because other states have had to have cleanups in their horrible areas too. And so that's my report. So who wants to be first with their report? And please introduce yourself and your district before you start telling us about the project from the 1900s. Representative Nornes.
I typically will go last, but I wanted to probably add one little bit to your story. Willard Munger grew up in my district. I just wanted to add that.
Absolutely, yeah.
I considered him a friend. He was sort of the end of his career when I was elected, and I remember walking to the top of Goat's Bluff down by Winona with him.
Uh-huh.
I thought, if he can get there, I can get there. It was a huff and a puff and kind of a big climb, but he had a walking stick, which helped him a little bit. So I'll just quickly go through a few things in my district, and I go back to about 1997, the first one. Arne Carlson was governor. And we built an event center, which had been something the community had asked for and hoped for a long time. So that got built attached to a major hotel, and that's been really a good thing. They built it too small, but you do what you do with what you've got. So a couple other things.
And was that in what town was
Fergus Falls.
Fergus Falls, okay.
Yeah. So I'll identify, Fergus Falls also has a veterans home. There have been a few additions. We built on a dining room and a memory unit over the last 10 years, which has been very, very necessary. We have a prairie wetlands learning center where we built some additional classrooms and a greenhouse with bonding money. Regional treatment center, which was a gift to the city from the state, which they'd like to return if they could, but it came without any guarantee, so they got it. And so we've been trying to repurpose that, and there's been some bonding money authorized to help get that done. One other more recent, we've had some high water. We've got 1,040 lakes in my county or my district, and we had three of them that were extremely high where people could not live in their homes anymore. Wells were contaminated. Septic systems didn't work. It was a tragedy that had to be corrected, and that was helped with some bonding money within the last couple of years. That's been very helpful, although I just received a note that it's about $3 million short of what they need to pay all the bills. So the project's done, pretty much, but the $10 million that was authorized is maybe just a little shy of what actually turned out to be the price. So I think that there are a number of other smaller ones. We added on a large addition to our community college structure in Fergus Falls, part of M-State. It tied everything together, so everything is this was a large meeting area right in the center of the campus, but everything is now enclosed so that students do not walk outside anymore, which is kind of a nice thing in the wintertime. So I think that pretty well covers it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And the number of your district?
8A.
All right. Representative Considine.
Considine. And my grandmother was a Murphy.
Aren't you lucky?
Yeah. Yes. I guess I would just like to talk about the last 2 years. The one is in my district, which is the clinical science building at MSU that got finished and is now in operation so that the students have access to the building that was actually built in 13 and 14, but that has been a tremendous boon for the students at Minnesota State Mankato. And of course the other one is next door. It's not actually in my district, it's in 19A, and that would be the security hospital. And I would just say that the staff and residents are very grateful for the bonding committee for having upgraded that facility and making it a lot safer in 2 years ago. So thank you to the bonding committee for those two things.
Representative Constantine.
Dine.
Representative Constantine. Could you tell us a little more about the St. Peter facility before 2000?
Before 2000. What was referred to as the new building came online in 1982. By coincidence, I started working there in 83, and it was considered a marvel. The previous building had come from the 1800s, and it was something out of a Gothic horror story. I mean, it could have been the setting for a movie. It was, people were frightened just to walk by it. It was so imposing. But the old build, or the new building, new old building, was supposed to be a marvel. And of course, they found out right away that it wasn't. There were a number of security measures. Saw a patient take recessed screws out with his bare hands. It was supposed to be impossible to do, but he did it. And they came in and said, okay, we're not going to have problems with people busting up the toilets anymore. Old porcelain toilets, they put stainless steel toilets that were attached to the walls. It was the second day they opened up that somebody ripped one of them off the wall. With determination, you can overcome a lot of the safety procedures. Sight lines were terrible. One of the things that's kind of interesting, if you see people that you know
work there, when they walk up to a corner in the building, they will automatically step out away and look around the corner. Because unfortunately what happens a lot of times with poor sight lines is that there would be a patient standing at the corner waiting for them to walk around, and they would cold cock them. So all these things have improved. They've learned in the last 30 years that some of the things that they thought were going to work just didn't work. But particularly the sight lines are important, so you see what's coming at you ahead of time. And that's one of the things that made it a lot safer. I'm trying to think of some of the other more innovative. Some of the outdoor space still relied on razor wire as a deterrent. Any psychotic person isn't necessarily deterred and would go right up through it and get cut to ribbons, which is not something we want our patients to endure. So a lot of the outdoor space has now been made more secure without the threat of something happening to people. So it, in general, has been a lot of different improvements, small little improvements in a lot of different areas.
Thank you very much. Second volunteer, third volunteer? To talk about projects in your district that the state invested in before 1900 or before 2000? Representative Bennett.
Madam Chair, thank you so much. And this is fun.
It is.
It is very fun. I enjoyed hearing your historical one. I don't have quite as far back for my area.
You're not as old.
That's true. So maybe not, though. No. But I do have one that I'll call a small project with a big bang, and that is our Blazing Star Trail. And it actually began in 1996, so we did reach a little bit into the 1900s, with legislative authority. The bonding did not start then, but the trail was authorized by the legislature. The Blazing Star Trail, the goal is to link Albert Lea all the way through Hayward to Austin going east, and then the Austin area has the Shooting Star Trail, which I've actually walked before as well. So we would have a nice southern Minnesota trail. So the Blazing Star Trail starts in Albert Lea. And in 2005, the bonding committee at that time gave $1.5 million for that trail. That was actually supposed to complete the entire trail from Albert Lea to Austin. But as as finances go, it didn't make it even close to that. But we're still working on it. So right now, the trail goes from Albert Lea, and what's really neat about it is it goes through our state park, Homer Myrie Big Island State Park, which has over 100,000 visitors a year. And the trail goes there. There's a gap because there's a small area where a bridge is needed over a little portion of, like, an arm of our lake. And then in Hayward, on the other side of that arm of the lake, there is a little bit of the trail completed, not much. Now, the city of Hayward, not Hayward, Wisconsin, but Hayward, Minnesota, has about 244 people living there. And what is significant is back when this trail started and funding was given in 2005, the DNR asked the city of Hayward, this little city, to have some skin in the game. And they said, all right, we'll do that. And those 244 people were able to raise enough money through their city and through other donations to build a really nice park and bathroom complex there. And that really nice little park and the bathrooms are still sitting there waiting for the trail, the gap that needs to be completed. So my goal and our goal as a city is to get that little gap completed. The trail has been highly used thus far in our area, even though it dead ends. The people walk it, they bike it, and even in Hayward, the little mile spot that they have, they use. So to get it finished would be really wonderful because people would have more of a clear way through. So just want to share that because it's been a blessing to our area. We also, Albert Lea was designated as a Blue Zones city. I don't know if people are familiar with that term at all. And I can't even remember the name of the gentleman who wrote the book, Blue Zones, but it's a healthy lifestyle type principle. And, of course, exercise is part of that. And so that trail has been a big part of making our lives just a little more wonderful. And it's beautiful because part of it goes along Albert Lea Lake. So just wanted to share that. It's been a real blessing, and we're hoping to get that finished.
Very good. I hope so, too. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and approach it from a couple of angles. First, as chair of this committee the past couple of years, tried to invest in the infrastructure across the state. I'm, pleased that we're able to put in record amounts for PFA, the clean water, the wastewater programs across our state that are so important to our particularly smaller towns. Local bridges, local roads, we also put a higher emphasis on. Of course, the state capitol, I wasn't chair of the committee then, but was very involved in the bonding proposals to restore our state capitol to its previous and present splendor. But then, on more local projects, of course, the most important one that we did was the Hermantown Wellness Center. Better.
Good. They put the windows in.
Good. But in my home area, we are home to the First District Association, which is the dairy processing plant in Litchfield, becoming a very massive facility covering several city blocks in Litchfield. 7 million pounds of milk every day come down the streets of Litchfield to First District. And they could not accommodate, they could not process all of this milk. We're having to send it on to other processing plants. And so they needed some assistance in order to expand to be able to accommodate the need. So there are a couple of pieces of legislation that this bonding committee passed dealing with that, both of them to the city of Litchfield, one for the ability to Litchfield to expand its wastewater treatment plant facilities because the First District uses an awful lot of water. Half of the wastewater treatment plant water that comes to it each day comes from First District. So a city of 7,000 people and, half of its wastewater is First District. And so legislation was passed, bonding money appropriated to allow the city of Litchfield to expand its wastewater. And then we also subsequent to that, the need was determined for electrical generation backup that the city could not provide for First District or, frankly, for the town if there was an emergency. And so new electrical generation facilities were installed as a result of bonding. And I have a small little item that is important. I like to see buildings restored. So the state capitol, one of the areas that I like to see the building restored. And in my hometown of Litchfield, we have the Litchfield Opera House. And through legacy and through some bonding money, we're getting awful close to having that restored to its 1900 and 1935 era, because there's two different phases that the building went through. So we can do a lot of good things with bonding, a lot of good things for the state of Minnesota, addressing needs, addressing infrastructure needs in particular, but also addressing some of the needs that many of you have in your local communities. And I look forward to seeing more of those and being reminded of some things maybe that we didn't quite get done in the past. And hopefully through the fine leadership of Chair Murphy, we'll be able to get these things done.
And daily reminders.
Never hurts.
Works for me.
Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, yes. Well, good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
And fellow members and members of the public. My name is Dan Wolgamott. I'm representing District 14B in the St. Cloud area. And it is with great pride that I speak to you today about the Herb Brooks National Hockey and Event Center, which was funded by the state of Minnesota for $10 million in the year 1988. The Herb, as we like to call it, is home to the SCSU Husky men's and women's Division I hockey teams. It plays host to many teams, including my alma mater, St. John's University. And it also happens to be the place where I went on a first date with a very beautiful woman who turned out to be my wife.
Okay.
So in my opinion, it's worth every penny of that $10 million from the state. It really is. It's had a tremendous impact on our university and our community and our state. It's strengthened St. Cloud's status as a regional center. It's increased the visibility of our university regionally, nationally, internationally. It's not only assisted our program, but it's assisted the elevation of MSU Mankato and Bemidji State to Division I hockey. It's allowed for the elevation of women's hockey in Minnesota and the establishment of the women's WCHA. And it hasn't just benefited college athletics. It's created a platform for Husky Productions, which is the student-run broadcast production that gives the students the chance to get hands-on and has given us our mass communications program the reputation one of the best in the country. It fosters a strong youth hockey program and just really provides a sense of community pride and entertainment opportunities for corporate partners, alumni, and friends of the program, as well as hosting several university and community events. Madam Chair, a little background on the history of the project. I'm told that former Representative Glenn Anderson from Southern Minnesota and Joe Quinn from Blaine were instrumental in working with St. Cloud's legislative delegation, which includes our former Representative Bernie Oman, who I'm honored is here with us today. They worked together, and they made this project a bipartisan reality. And I hope that we here in this committee can look at that project as an example for us of the power of what can happen when we can come together and invest in projects that are going to support our regional centers and our state as a whole. I'd also like to give recognition to Representative Erdahl, who is a proud Husky alum and distinguished alumni and great St. Cloud State supporter.
Hear that one again?
Yeah. Very distinguished alum, as well as Representative Bennett is a Husky alum as well, and very supportive of our university. So, Madam Chair, on behalf of St. Cloud State University and the people of St. Cloud, I'd like to thank you, as well as Chair Carlson, for voting for this important project in 1988, because it's had a profound impact on our community and our status as a regional center. And I also want to do a special shout-out to the men's Husky hockey team, who have been ranked number one in the state for 7 weeks straight. Country. Although, Madam Chair, they split last weekend with the Bulldogs, so I guess we'll have to agree to disagree on that. They have temporarily temporarily down to number two in the country. But without a doubt, this capital investment has ranked in the top of the hearts of the people in St. Cloud, and I hope we can use it as a model moving forward.
Good. Very good.
Football.
Very good. You know, at one time, I represented District 14B.
Ah.
But the numbers change. Well, with each redistricting.
Well, glad to be part of the 14B area. Club with you, Madam Chair.
Very, very good. And we'll go forth and build more things that have so much impact. Who's next? Representative Dean?
I didn't want to go after Representative Wolgemont, but
I guess I have to since you called on me. So when I think back to before 2000, a lot of this stuff was not on my radar. But when I think about the city of Minneapolis and some of the things that we've been, that the state has partnered with us, there's some pretty critical projects. I had the good fortune on Sunday night to actually be walking down Nicollet Mall. And it was amazing to see the people that were out. Now, granted, the weather was really nice, so there were a lot more people, and it was really, really enjoyable to see that project completed. And what it's going to mean to our downtown. And when I thought of this notion of, you know, the impact of that project, I think of a project that was really, really critical to the city, and I want to thank who was then Chair Torkelson for the 10th Avenue Bridge money. The 10th Avenue Bridge actually became the new artery when the 35W Bridge collapsed. And the amount of cars and the use that bridge had gotten caused it to age fairly rapidly over that period of time. So I just want to take a moment and thank you, Representative Torkelson. And then thinking back to what's happened in our city over time, I think of the theater district, something that had sort of disappeared in Minneapolis. And then with the redevelopment of the State Theater, a really, really critical project, all of a sudden the theater district got reborn. And subsequent to that time, the state has assisted in a couple of the theater projects, but one of them is no longer sort of on that area. It's on the river now, and it overlooks the Stone Arch Bridge, and that's the Guthrie Theater, which is one of the top repertory theaters in the country. And it still continues that legacy of being a place that many actors go to as one of the top theaters outside of New York City. For those of you who don't know, per capita, Minneapolis has the highest number of arts centers next to New York City. So we're actually a pretty important piece when we think of the theater, when we think of the arts, and when we think of what I consider to be a great state of Minnesota. But the project that I actually want to see happen is not in my district. It's a project that I fell in love with before I got into the legislature, and that's the Chatfield Center for the Arts. It's
the music.
Well, no, it's a different one. Yeah, and I think what a lot of people maybe don't think of that, although it's close to Rochester, it's a regional draw in and of itself. The venue and the types of musicians and folks that come and play there get people from all around coming down from Rochester. So it's again, one of those regional centers, which I think is really, really critical to the state of Minnesota and ultimately is going to be really critical to what I've come to understand is our small towns and those things that make them draw. When we think of, you know, areas like Lanesboro, you know, that's a town that 30, 40 years ago, if the state and other people wouldn't have invested, that might not really be the town it is today. So when You know, I represent Minneapolis, so I think a lot about Minneapolis, but I also think about those other smaller towns and those regions that are just as critical for the people that live in those areas as well. So, you know, the state has been a great partner, and I look forward to the state continuing that partnership with the city.
Good. And that's really a good point that you made, and represent Bennett, too, and with these trail things. They've got to connect. They've got to bring the people so that they, you can get from one part of the state to the other part of the state by the trails that connect. And that brings the people together and brings... Trails are just like the freeways, you know? They go both ways. And when you're on them, you can go that way and you can go that way. And with the trails, you go around, you meander more, but still, you can go to and from and around, and we've just got to get more connectivity. And that's a challenge that's being pointed out. We can't have that dead end for too many years.
If I could just jump on that, Madam Chair. I think that connectivity goes beyond trails. I think it should be part of everything that we try to do here as we work with our fellow colleagues on trying to move those initiatives that are really important to the people of Minnesota. I think that, you know, there are some times we don't connect with other members, and I think that sometimes that makes that our work here a little bit more difficult. But the more that we can make those connections, and remember that before we're all elected officials, we're all people. And we, you know, need a lot of things that people need, too, not just what elected officials need.
Absolutely. Right on. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. Just wanted to expound a little bit more on Chatfield. But first of all, we have connectivity within this committee. I mean, I think you were alluding to it a little bit, but... frankly, we're one of the least partisan committees in the legislature. And you would all be welcome when we are touring the state looking at projects to join the back of the bus caucus, but then it wouldn't be a back of the bus caucus because you'd all be in it. But anyway, Chatfield, of course, Chair Murphy was familiar with the music,
the sheet music library
that became infamous in a bonding bill some years back. But what Representative Dean was referencing, the Chatfield Center for the Arts, a very it was an old school in Chatfield, formerly a high school, and it's been greatly restored, but not quite finished off. And if we could have got above $825 million in GO bonds last time, I think we would have, you know, tried to do a little bit more for the Chatfield Center for the Arts. And I think that is something we should be taking a good look at this year, particularly when you consider, members, that there is a spot on the former gymnasium floor where Greg Davids won a high school wrestling match. Yeah, I think there should be a star placed upon that spot.
So, Representative Erdahl, he won a match in high school?
Oh, yes.
He won a match in high school.
Well, I'm sure that Representative Davids won many, many matches.
We digress.
I have one quick question. Mr. Lee, what bridge did we do in Minneapolis in 2017?
Madam Chair and Representative Dean, 2017, the Minneapolis Bridge was the 10th Avenue Bridge.
So I was chair of the committee when we did the 10th Avenue Bridge?
Madam Chair and Representative Dean, the 10th Avenue Bridge project was also included in the 2006 bonding bill that passed the House but did not pass the Senate.
So thank you very much for that clarification.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, I recall now We were also working with who was then transportation chair, Representative Torkelson, so I apologize to you, Representative Rudolph.
And Representative Torkelson got that in the 2016 bill, just as unfortunately things didn't quite work out.
Thank you for those clarifications.
Madam Chair?
Representative Lilly.
I just want to interrupt for a second. I liked how Minneapolis lobbied that bridge, because do you remember how they had us park on the bridge and it was moving? I thought that was pretty clever of Minneapolis to have the bus parked
there. That's not encourage tricks to get our attention.
It was scary.
We don't want tricks to get our attention.
This is a bad bridge.
Okay, next volunteer, Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, it's a pleasure to be back on this committee. I'm in my second term and also second term on the Capital Investment Committee. There's some familiar faces, some new faces around this table, and also from in the gallery watching today. The project that I want to talk about does not go back into the 90s. It just goes back to last year. And that is the Hero Center, a law enforcement training center in Cottage Grove. I'm thankful to Chair Erdahl and other members of the committee for funding this, and it's a very important need, and it's so important that we also had the Smart Center in Dakota County, another law enforcement training center. Some concern that we had initially was that one project might get weighted against the other, and I'm happy that we saw that these are actually two very separate projects with two very separate missions for law enforcement training, and we were able to fund both of those. The Hero Center in Cottage Grove is a joint partnership between the City of Woodbury and the City of Cottage Grove, but users will come from all over the East Metro and perhaps even further, and as well as the Smart Center in Dakota County, and will bring users from across the county to that facility as well. More broadly speaking, you know, we all have a responsibility to our districts. And what I like about this committee is that it allows us to look broader than our districts and to look throughout the entire state of Minnesota, whether we're talking HEPA projects or Public Facilities Authority for Clean Water. We really get to see these projects firsthand on the bonding tour, which is eye-opening. It's better than just having a PowerPoint presentation in this committee. Those will come, but when they do, we can recall our trips to those projects, whether it's Chatfield, whether it's to a fish hatchery, or to Minneapolis in Representative Lee's district, or wherever it is. And so I'm looking forward to that, and I echo what Chair Representative Erdahl said about this being a bipartisan committee. That is something that I'm very proud of, too, to be a part of this and building those relationships with all members, regardless of party. And some of those relationships are built in the back of the bus on the bonding tours, like Representative Erdahl said. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to being a part of this committee for another 2 years.
Very good. Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to compliment you on the tone that you're setting for this committee. It reminds me a little bit of the legacy committee that I was vice chair of last year. I think it has the biggest opportunity to be a bipartisan in nature, and I appreciate the materials. It looks like we are, you know, geographically distributed. That's really helpful to see. With the danger of bringing Representative Erdahl back into the conversation here, I'd like to play a little bit off of Representative Dean's comments about the arts and bring you up to northern Minnesota, because my background is economic development, and I have come to recognize and appreciate the role that the arts play in economic development. When we are recruiting professionals to the area, and really healthcare is the biggest employer now in northern Minnesota, when we are recruiting doctors, physicians, other professionals, we find that those families are looking for something to do year-round, and they're looking for enrichment opportunities not only for themselves but for their children. So they're looking for good schools,
but they're also looking for the arts. And I will say that Grand Rapids has sort of seen itself as sort of the northern mecca for the arts. And I don't know, Chair Murphy, if you've been to the Miles Reiff Performing Arts Yes. Center. You have. I imagine you have. This, again, is not the Reiff Center started before the year 2000, but I want to talk about our investment since that time. When I moved to the Grand Rapids area, if you wanted to see a local play or maybe the local high school play, you went to the high school gym, and everybody had folding chairs, and we sat on the floor of the gym. But we had some real arts advocates and people that were philanthropists locally. And they had a vision to create something bigger than that. And the Reiff Center was created. The name Miles Reiff was a very well-known, well-loved manager of the Blandon Paper Companies. And Blandon Paper Company is kind of the heart of Grand Rapids. And they also had the vision to bring youth into the arts. So the Reiff Center was built adjacent to, connected to the Grand Rapids High School. So the Reiff Center is available to students to use during the day. And as a result, we have dance programs that have come up. We have youth music programs that have come up. But the last couple of years, we had two different bonding projects. And Chair Udall will remember me chasing him down the hall last bonding session, trying to get that extra $500,000 for the Miles Reiff Center. I think we've put in a little more than $4 million to the Reiff Center, but we have expanded now to two theaters. One is in excess of 600-seat theater. The other is a 200-seat theater. But each year, the Reiff Center hosts more than 50 national and international touring performances. I mean, that's extraordinary. It's with all disciplines. The expansion is also provided for opportunity for visual arts. So there's not only is there performing arts, but there's an art gallery as you come in. The two theaters are named after two philanthropic families, the Ives and the Wilcoxes. They stood up and put up $500,000 and challenged the community to match that. And so I guess I would just like to say that I like to see when the state comes in and partners with communities on their assets, looks at what they're trying to do to bring more economic development, more enrichment, quality of life features to their community and partner. And then I would just add, this is indoor entertainment and arts, but I would also like to say that trails are really important. And in northern Minnesota and on the Iron Range, we're recognizing that and looking at some of our old mining areas where we have the old hills and beautiful, actually, features as a result of mining, and we're putting in mountain bike trails. And so last session, in addition to the Reiff, we were able to get $1 million, just a small amount, for a trail right next to my home called the Tioga Pit Trail. And that's taken an old Tioga Pit. You know, it's the only hills we have in Minnesota, in northern Minnesota, are the pits, and turning it into mountain biking. The Cuyuna Range has used this as a tremendous economic development feature. It's sort of transformed those communities now that people are coming there to do mountain biking. They're staying overnight. They're eating in the restaurants and so on. So, you know, I would just commend the group for their investments in the arts and indoors and outdoor recreation in northern Minnesota and all across the state.
Thank you, Representative Lehman. The first time I went to the Reiff was to see a Minneapolis dance troupe that was in residence at the Reiff. And the city kids and the country kids all got together and had a beautiful recital. And I was just amazed at what the kids could do in that small amount of time. Now, it seems to me that I was told that the Grand Rapids kids had gone down to the Minneapolis place for a period of days, and then the Minneapolis kids came up and spent time up there. And so this was the culmination of the two experiences that those students had had in very different age groups, too. And I was just amazed.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that having an asset like the Miles Rick Performing Arts Center allows for partnerships between the, you know, as Representative Dean talked about, the arts and culture features the Twin Cities. More and more are looking to bring their expertise out to rural communities, and having something like the Rife Center allows them to do that.
Yep. Thank you very much, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lee from District 59A, and just want to echo the point that was made by Representative Dean, my colleague on the other side. Just want to say thank you to the committee and the state for investing in the city of Minneapolis, which is a regional hub for the state of Minnesota. And I do want to note that the 90s, I was still a young child, so I had some help with from Jenny Nash and from Gene Renier from the city of Minneapolis to look at projects in the 1990s that were specifically for my district. And we found out that in 1998, the state of Minnesota made an investment to the Humboldt Greenway project in my district to acquire some land for green space for infrastructure improvements and reclamation of wetland amenities for public use and construction of parkway. And I can say that over the last 4 years, we have seen many developments around that area with regards to single-family homes, townhomes, and then we also had a senior home that was built because of that investment. So I just want to say thank you again to the members who were there to help support this project. And a recent project that I just want to highlight was last year with the last bonding bill. Just want to say thank you to Representative Erdahl for his leadership in investing in the Upper Harbor Terminal projects, which is about 48 acres of land on the Mississippi River, for those who may not know, that, you know, has not been in use after Congress have closed the barge traffic coming up the Mississippi River. And now that we're seeing that up in my district, the Upper Harbor Terminal project, you know, may be similar to what we have saw with the Humboldt Greenway project of actually developing a community in North Minneapolis. And one of my local paper mentioned that, you know, we have Minnesotans from different parts of the states that are moving into my district, from my Sansi, from other parts of Minneapolis, and from the suburbs. And so just know that the community members in my district are, you know, really appreciative of the investment from the state. And just want to echo some of the comments made by colleagues around the table, that I really look forward to serving on the committee, especially traveling throughout the state. And I have, over the last 2 years, traveled to Grand Rapids and down to Chatfield, passing through Chatfield to go visit Representative Rick Hansen down by his farm. And so I look forward to taking a look at some of the art and some of the centers that were mentioned today. I just want to say thank you all for the investment into my district and throughout the state of Minnesota.
Thank you very much. Mr. Straczynski, would you come down? In the note that I sent you, I said I asked to prepare a short report, up to 5 minutes, talking about a project in the 1900s, in the 20th century, that made cultural changes and so forth. And then I said, two people, as well as in the note, that I hoped, and I set it on the agenda for Thursday, that we would finish up the reports from the committee members, and then we would ask the followers of the Capital Investment Committee to give a report as they saw it on projects that changed lives before the 20th, or in the 20th century, that led us up to the capital investments report that Mr. Lee gave us at the beginning. To set the basis of the importance of state investment in communities across the state and the connectedness that you've mentioned today in your story, in your reports and stories. And I know it's difficult, but don't let us do the last 18 years quite yet for naming the wonderful results we've had. We have to have more examples of the wonderful results that Mr. Lee referred to from the past. And on Sunday, I received an email from former Commissioner Straczynski, who gave his thought of what I was asking for. And I invited him to come and give his report today, so that sets the standard or the the level we're at and what kinds of things I kind of want to hear. But nothing that I've heard today has been tossed away. It has all been important, and it's all setting the tone for the future. And we're on our way to the adventure. But I think this is just going to give us the icing. Mr. Straczynski.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, members of the committee. I sent this document to Representative Murphy because I've been involved in the capital investment bonding projects since 1973 in different capacities, and I thank all of you because you voted for a variety of projects I've lobbied for, whether I was with the executive. Mary, you were there in those days, and or with some nonprofits I've represented over the years, but thank you. I just wanted to kind of set the stage from my perspective. I've been involved in countless capital investment projects over the past 46 years. Early in my professional career, while serving in the Department of Administration, I was responsible for preparing the governor's executive budget, which comes to your committees today. That's now created, presented by the Department of Management and Budget, which we did all that in administration in the old days. Over the decades, I've witnessed many changes in the process. And while many of the changes have been good, I think others have also added unnecessary levels of oversight and burden in some instances. But that's kind of a continuing issue that will face this committee on an ongoing basis and also face bond counsel on an ongoing basis. And staff's done a good job in addressing some of these issues. At one time, there was a Legislative Building Commission. That commission, last time I was involved, was chaired by Representative Delbert Anderson, who Representative Anderson's uncle, in fact. That goes back a long time. It was a joint commission of legislators from the House and Senate, as well as members from the executive branch of government. And the LBC, as we called it in those days, worked closely with the executive in preparing legislation, which was easily supported on a bipartisan basis because it had a variety of members on it and equal representation. As I recall, in those days, a $60 or $70 million capital investment or bonding bill, as we called it, could accommodate most of the construction needs of the states and projects, but those days are long since passed. But I've been consistently throughout my career been impressed with the fact that the easiest capital budget bills are to pass. That pass are those that are mindful of to balance greater Minnesota interest with metro interest and to accommodate the political interests throughout the state of Minnesota. After all, the need to enhance infrastructure, construct, or remodel buildings is not usually based on partisan politics, but are more frequently based on economic necessity or opportunity. We all know many good projects that would not have happened if it were not for the generosity
of the state legislature in providing seed or matching grants. We are all winners when we all benefit. Now think about it this way. Almost any worthwhile project would certainly be too expensive for local taxpayers to shoulder the total cost. When the state of Minnesota uses its geobond capacity, the financial burden for those many good projects are allocated statewide to all taxpayers. And over time, every region of the state benefits, and each of our communities are better served through this wonderful mechanism that infuses taxpayer capital where necessary and when needed. Now let me share with you the benefits, I think, of using state geobond resources to help finance local projects for nonprofits, something where I spent a great deal of my time. Whether it's a capital grant for a food bank, an art institution, a domestic abuse facility, or a public television station, it can easily be assumed that none of these projects would have been realized without state support. Yet we all know the significant role each of these local assets play in making our lives better. Each grantee relies on the state to be the partner in their quest to provide services. Project proponents are not asking the state taxpayers to totally cover the cost of these initiatives, but to act as a financial partner that helps leverage support from other philanthropic interests and from across the region and the state. The state of Minnesota, in turn, cannot afford the total cost of such worthwhile projects, regardless of their purpose and the contributions they make. Thus, this private-public partnership works best in the interest of all citizens. It is important to note the state gets twice as much construction, by the way, for half the cost, usually. The capital budget process selects brick-and-mortar projects to be funded. That's what you do. In other words, the legislature provides funding for governmental agencies and nonprofit grant recipients to remodel, update, address deferred maintenance through asset preservation, or build and equip a new facility. This is merely the foundation of the project. What is most important to this is the services that will be provided in that facility. These buildings enable services to be delivered that improves the lives of people on a statewide or regionally significant basis. The building is the tool, and the services are the value that's added. Some examples include education and training facilities, incarceration, research, preservation of a historical asset, and supporting routine government functions. The benefit of using GO bonds to update or construct new facilities is to allow the value to be distributed. Let me break it down a little further for you, if I may. I'll use the state capital funding projects for public television stations to illustrate my point that using GO bonds for the benefit of collaborating state and local nonprofit partners is important. In many states throughout the country, public television is owned by the respective state government. Maybe it might be a university system. As in the case in most of the states surrounding Minnesota, that's the case that exists. The impact of state ownership means that taxpayers in each of these states pays all the costs associated with providing the public broadcast services to their citizens. In Minnesota, the six public television stations are owned by the communities in which they are located, but they are collectively serve all of Minnesota. Consistent with this business model, state government, therefore, is not obligated to cover the cost, but rather only a portion of the costs. Citizens, corporations, and philanthropic organizations also contribute, therefore, to the financial success of the station. In addition, each station is regionally significant and provides state benefits. They provide cradle-to-grave educational services and create better informed and engaged citizens through public affairs and news programming. They bring the wonderful world of the arts into each home and provide historical documentaries to educate us all and to help us reflect on our past. Each station uses the power of public media to preserve and protect our democracy because they are not beholden to corporate interests or special interests. Congress knew this would be the case when they reserved public television frequencies for non-commercial broadcasters in the 1940s, and the purpose was to provide a forum for the public to freely exchange ideas and debate the issues of liberty. This wonderful private-public partnership, as an example, has been critical to the success of each station and has truly enriched the lives of every citizen they serve. These brick-and-mortar facilities allow the public television stations to broadcast and deliver worthwhile services programming on a 24-hour-a-day basis. To further demonstrate each station's regional impact, I want to share a couple of statistics. Public television legacy programs document, promote, and preserve the arts through our cultural and history of Minnesota's diverse communities. Our public-private facility partnerships has enabled the Minnesota member stations to deliver 2,700 hours of broadcast legacy programs to 5 million people in our region. Nearly 15 million viewers reach this content online. 990 easily accessible online education guides were developed and made available to educators in the classrooms of the state through our projects. Since 2009, 15,000 artists and historians have been featured, and more than 7,000 collaborations have benefited our communities. Finally, there are more than 942 hours of legacy content available to stream. In many instances, our local contact is picked, our content is picked up and rebroadcast by PBS. As a result, in 2018, our Minnesota-based broadcasts, through legacy funding and other things that we do in our brick-and-mortar facilities, the broadcast reached nearly 89 million households in the United States. The feedback from consuming public has been overwhelming. Artists see increased traffic in their stores. Teachers are constantly using our content to enrich the lives of our children and to promote the next generation of good citizens. It can be easily declared, without the state providing bonding and cash for public television facility projects in the past, none of these wonderful programs, services, and opportunities would have been possible. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to present my thoughts.
Thank you so much. Very good thoughts. Sets a good guideline for us. Thank you. Members, we will continue with our reports on Thursday. There are 9 members to go. And Ms. Dyson and Ms. Nash are ready to help you if you're struggling to find something to name and talk about in your regions. And will the people that would like to follow from the audience that would like to follow Mr. Commissioner Straczynski's message, please let Ms. Nash know. So far we have one person that has applied, and we will welcome any other comments from the audience as well. You're going to be with us every day. You should be participating in some way, too. Up to 5 minutes on your report. Thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned. Yeah.